A big part of my graduate education at Harvard was critical thinking. The general idea that theories come and go, even the data come and go because it gets modified as new experimental paradigms are developed. So the idea of fixity that we know and it's set in stone was not at all in my thinking by the time I left graduate school, if it ever had been.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years. And have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening.
Hello, my name is Joel Whitebook. I'm an analyst from New York City, and I'm going to be the guest host for today's podcast, where I'll be talking with Fred Pine. Fred is Professor Emeritus in Psychiatry from the Albert Einstein School of Medicine. He received his PhD in 1956 from the almost legendary program in social relations at Harvard University. Then, after spending 6 years at the NYU Research Center for Mental Health, Fred took his analytic training at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. I'm especially pleased to be talking with Fred today because he's an old friend and colleague of mine. I first met him when I was an intern at Einstein, where Fred was the director of the psychology program, which meant at the time he was my boss, my supervisor, and my teacher. Then, after leaving Einstein, we remained good friends and colleagues for many years. I've often turned to Fred for consultations when I've had difficulties with cases and for his wise counsel when I've had difficulties in personal matters. In reading over Fred's material for preparing for this interview, and in listening to the interview, two things struck me. The first was what an independent thinker Fred is. And this raises the question, which you'll see is addressed in the interview, of what combination of personal factors and historical experiences come together to create an independent thinker. The second point that occurred to me is that in listening to Fred, one again realizes the opposition between creative thinking and conservatism, or between innovation and conservatism, is false. For it's often the case, not only in psychoanalysis, but in many fields, that the most creative individuals, the ones who make the most creative contributions, are often thoroughly grounded in tradition. In this respect, Fred's work can be compared to Hans Lowell's. Both of them were able to be open to examine the new developments that were taking place in the field, which we generally group together under the rubric of the pre-Oedipal turn, and to evaluate them and their consequences for classical theory. Thus, for example, because of his training in the academic world and as a researcher, and his sensitivity or his orientation to empirical data, Freud was able to examine Kohut's work and appropriate what was important about it without getting tied up in the ideological debates that often surrounded it. Finally, I'd like to conclude with one last observation. I've spoken to a number of colleagues from Fred's generation who also were trained at Orthodox institutes. And many of them are quite bitter about the experience that they had there. In fact, several have said to me, I don't know how we put up with it. Fred's attitude, on the contrary, is quite different. He not only seems very grateful for the experience he had in his training in New York Psychoanalytic, but he also, as you will hear, tells us how rich the experience was of practicing classical analysis and how much he actually learned and gained from it. As I said in my introduction, Fred, I think that your work and Lowell's can be compared to each other, although the comparison may not be obvious. Both of you were grounded in classical theory, but both of you were also open to appreciating the important developments that were occurring in what's generally referred to as the pre-Oedipal turn that was taking place in psychoanalysis in the second half of the 20th century, and both of you tried to evaluate what these new developments meant and what the implications were for classical theory. The difference between the two of you was, however, that whereas Lowald was originally trained as a philosopher, you were trained as a developmentalist and a researcher. So to begin our conversation, I'd like to invite you to tell us about your interesting training, your very rich training, first in the social relations program at Harvard, where you received your PhD, then at the NYU Research Center for Mental Health, where you did 6 years of empirical research, and finally at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, where you received your analytic training. After you've told us about that, I'm going to have a follow-up question. So, Fred, please.
Okay. So, you mentioned that I was trained as a developmentalist. Let me just correct that. My PhD is in clinical psychology. The developmental part came from personal interest and accidents of history. Just briefly on that, I was a camp counselor, a camp head counselor for years. I did my internship with children, or my psychology internship, though I never really distinguished between child and adult work. Raising my children was the central emotional event of my life. And then various research things happened with children, which I will tell you about as we go along. It's not only the pre-Oedipal turn, there was the relational turn. And beyond that, the explosion of ideas in the whole political world in the 60s, which I think spread into psychoanalysis. Don't trust anybody over 30, was the phrase back then. And it came to mean also, don't count on every theory you've heard from the past. And I think psychoanalysis loosened up. So that's general background. In terms of my own training, I went to City College in the, and the College of the City of New York, which then was a great academic center. The student belief, I don't know if it was true, was that we produced more future PhDs than any school in the country. Then I got accepted at Harvard. In Harvard, in the mid-1940s, and lasting only until the mid-1960s, there was a Department of Social Relations, which is where I got my PhD in clinical psychology. That department was formed with the idea of interdisciplinary knowledge. So clinical and social psychology split off from experimental psychology, joined with social anthropology, which had split off from physical anthropology, and further joined with sociology. So four sections, social and clinical psychology, sociology, social anthropology, under the leadership of Henry Murray, Gordon Allport, Clyde Cluckhone, and Talcott Parsons, four giants of their respective fields back then. I don't know how interdisciplinary they became, because they were already set in their professions. But I know they opened their minds to all the students, including this one, me, to just a broad range of ideas. I was already primed there, if you will, to think in integrative terms, to think broadly, to include a lot in my sort of mental maps. The first job I got after that was at NYU, New York University, where I spent 6 years at a place called the Research Center for Mental Health, headed by George Klein and Bob Holt, two very intelligent, analytically wise research psychologists. George had also had analytic training. And George Klein had been one of my teachers at Harvard, but had gone down to NYU in the interim and formed this research center. In spite of the name, Research Center for Mental Health, its aims were to study the psychoanalytic theory of thinking. And we did that through studying the effects on the mind of sensory deprivation, of incidental stimulation, of subliminal stimulation and incidental stimulation, of LSD, and a variety of other ways. What I got there was, I think, a really, I say it about myself, a rigorous mind. I learned to really respect evidence. I did 6 years of number crunching research. And the research I did was quite well received. It was published in good psychology journals. But towards the end of it, two things happened. One, I began to feel that that approach to the psychoanalytic mind was too sterile. And I was wasting my life, not only my professional life. At the same time, I had been doing some part-time work evenings at a clinic on the west side of Manhattan, where there was a therapeutic nursery very early on before those things were common. And I, among other things, I saw patients, but I also tested all the children year after year in that therapeutic nursery, 3 and 4 year olds. And in my rather naive beginning 25 to 30 year old psychologist mind back then, I wrote up everybody. I found myself trying not to be limited by writing up all the kids in terms of where they are in the oral, anal, genital phase, because that was sort of my beginning view of what psychoanalysis was about. And gradually I learned that where you differentiate people is in, I'll call it the ego functioning. And I developed the idea for a research study based on assessment of cognitive and motor functioning in 4 to 8 year olds in order to study the emergence of interests, defenses, and symptoms. And while I began with just a general curiosity, I rather rapidly developed a hypothesis, namely that people develop, that people use certain leading functions, I call them, like an emphasis on anticipation or on judgment or on gross motor activity or on organization and planning. And they approach many things in life that way. And so that those leading functions get involved in their interests on the one hand, the symptoms on the other, and their defenses on a third hand. I did an enormously well-received study over the course of 6 years at the Downstate Medical Center. Enormously well-received because at that time, longitudinal studies, there were many of them around the country that filled hundreds of drawers full of data that when nothing could ever be done with. But I restricted my data and managed to convert it all through rating schemes into quantitative data. The result after 6 years was zero quantitatively. At that time, I had a second feeling of, you're wasting your life, Fred. You're a smart guy. Don't do this.
Fred, excuse me, let me interrupt you. It kind of reminds me of what happened to Freud when he finally wrote up the project and he realized that a completely physicalist approach to the psyche wasn't going to work.
That's very good. I don't mind being compared to Freud, nor earlier to Lowell. So thank you, Joel. Anyway, at that point, I applied for and got a position as director of psychology in child psychiatry at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and soon after became overall director of psychology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And that was just a general academic job. I supervised, I was on committees, I taught, and I wrote. And during my years there, first I discovered that in the 6 years at Downstate, doing that child development, child longitudinal study research, I felt I had learned an enormous amount about children that didn't show in the quantitative data.
Had you entered psychoanalytic training at this point?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I entered psychoanalytic training at the point I went into Downstate. Yes. I had just graduated psychoanalytic training when I went to Einstein. So, but when I was at Einstein, I discovered that I had learned an enormous amount about children, and I began my writing on development, and my early papers are largely about development. But two other things were going on. One, I was supervising a lot of clinical work. I did a lot of clinical teaching, supervision and teaching, and it gave me contact with a very wide array of patients. I was often supervising 12 candidates a year, 6 interns, 3 child psychiatry fellows, and 3 chief residents, usually. And so I was experiencing a whole array of people in psychological need who would never be in psychoanalysis. And so I had to become creative about the psychotherapy in order to accomplish anything in that.
I remember when you were supervising us, you used to ask us not to bring our easy cases, but to bring our most difficult and impossible cases.
Well, it was a challenge that I tried to meet with people like you and for me. And so I had the developmental history. I had the array of psychotherapy patients that I was supervising. And I had begun an analytic practice, having just graduated, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Those various threads all came together as time went on in my various expansions of psychoanalytic theory and my integrationist approach.
Okay, let me, before I ask you my follow-up question, two things struck me in what you said. The first was, and I've always believed this myself, was how much the general anti-authoritarianism of the 60s culture really served to undermine, to use a popular word, the hegemony of New York ego psychology, which was rather rigid and rather authoritarian. And somehow the ancien regime couldn't withstand what was the challenge that the 60s anti-authoritarianism was posing to it. And secondly, the way you described your experience at Harvard in the social studies program, it reminded me you, in a way, were exposed to the sort of broad cultural education that Freud really talked about and what he wanted for analysts when he wrote his paper about his dream of a psychoanalytic university. I mean, you can comment on that. Just these are impressions. But let me get to my follow-up question then. You said that your academic training and research academic background and research training really gave you the independence to sort of strike out on your own and develop your own creative position. So with regard to your classical training at New York Psychoanalytic, which was often known for its dogmatism, you were able to critically appropriate what was being presented to you without having to sort of uncritically accept it, submit to it. And with regard to the new developments and the new theories with Kohut and other people, you were able to look at the evidence of what was being put forward and sift it out and again critically appropriate it, without getting entangled in the more political and ideological debates that were going on in the 70s and the 80s. So can you comment on all of that?
Yes, I can. First of all, I was very receptive. I was in psychoanalytic training from 1962 to 1968 at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute in what was then called the Research Students Program. Psychoanalysis back then, official psychoanalysis, decided they need more research, and so they began to take in selected psychologists for a special training. The training was identical to what everybody else had, but the hope was that we would be doing research in psychoanalysis. And of the initial group, George Klein, Donald Spence, Irving Paul, Leo Goldberg, and myself, all of us stayed in full-time academic life for a long, long time. I was in academic life full-time for 35 years. At any rate, I was very receptive to what I was learning at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. It did not feel dogmatic. It felt true. I was learning the truth. It was very compelling. But the atmosphere wasn't dogmatic. Occasionally, there were some instructors who were, of course. But in general, discussion in seminars was very active, very open. It was not as though everything had a set or pat answer. And so it was all very exciting. It was after that that things started happening, which led to my own expansions. First of all, as part of the background, a big part of my graduate education at Harvard was critical thinking. The general idea that theories come and go, even the data come and go, because it gets modified as new experimental paradigms are developed. So the idea of fixity that we know and it's set in stone was not at all in my thinking by the time I left graduate school, if it ever had been. And the other thing which you alluded to, I had an academic position. I was by then an associate professor with tenure at Einstein and moved into a professorship at Einstein by 1973, I think. A tenured professorship gives you a lot of independence. That's the whole idea of academic freedom. But more than that, specifically, I was never dependent upon referrals to earn my income. Partly I was becoming well known and I had plenty of referrals, but I had a salary and I was living largely on a salary with a small practice. And I was never dependent on the people from the Institute to give me my professional status or my professional referrals. I think that's very freeing. If that's your primary reference group, the New York Psychoanalytic or any institute, then you're going to want to fit in order to rise within the organization and receive referrals and be respected. I don't think I was not respected, and I was invited to be a training analyst, but I was never dependent on it. So I could lead an independent professional life. The Institute was never my main home. My main home was the university. And in my own head now, though it's almost 30 years since I took a professor emeritus status, because I'm turning 90 this month, the university after 30 years still remains my primary internal reference group. And especially those early colleagues from the Research Center for Mental Health. So that's on maintaining my independence.
What you're saying is sort of interesting with respect to what you might call the sociology of psychoanalytic training, because as I was rereading your material to prepare for this, and again, it was reinforced by what you just said, I was struck by your attitude towards your training and your real gratitude towards it, because I know so many older colleagues from your generation who went through not just New York Psychoanalytic, but other mainstream institutes who are, in fact, when you talk to them, are very bitter about their experience. I mean, people said to me, I don't know how he put up with it. But unlike you, from what you're saying, many of them, because they were dependent on the Institute, had to be more submissive and couldn't really develop their own autonomous position. So I think that's very interesting.
Well, let me comment on that. It's personal history, but in a personal interview, I suppose it's of interest. After my back then, your analysts had to approve your beginning control cases and your progression. After my first year of analysis, my analyst asked me to delay taking on a training case. Why? So I could get further into my analysis. Well, I was, I never delayed anything. I always did things quickly. And I said, then I'm going to quit. And I was really prepared to quit. And he said, why would you do that? He said, some of our best candidates delay. There's nothing wrong with it. I just think you'll get more out of your cases if you get another year of analysis in.
You didn't point out that taking on cases can also deepen your analysis.
But it was stepwise. That did happen, but that was stepwise. At any rate, I did stay, and I did, of course, graduate. Anyway, that's just a little personal bit.
But what really strikes me, Fred, is that, in reading your work again, is, you have, unlike many people who felt like they had to break with sort of the classical paradigm, you really feel a good deal of gratitude towards it, and like it gave you a very rich experience from which you could move on.
That's what I wanted to say in response to your comment. Yes, I did. I had no regret and no resentment about the process. And there was more that happened. When I presented on this once to a Division 39 meeting of the American Psychological Association, the Division of Psychoanalysis, people were horrified, but I wasn't at all. And I'll tell you what it was. So when the research candidates like myself graduated, the Institute graduated us with only two cases. The regular candidates generally had three. They graduated with two cases because since we were psychologists, they didn't see that they could allow us to see patients privately for a fee. So I was seeing two patients five times a week each, plus an hour of supervision, which was free. So that's 10, 12 hours a week of commitment to analytic work for no money. They felt they couldn't ask us to do a third case for free, and they couldn't ask us to see a third case for money because we were PhDs and we weren't supposed to be doing that. So they graduated us with two cases. So then none of us joined the Institute as members because the Institute, New York Psychoanalytic Rules back then, the bylaws said that psychologists could not practice analysis or psychotherapy. And how that got into the bylaws, I don't know, but we felt we were trained independently for psychotherapy in our graduate programs. When Sam Atkins, an analyst at the New York, became president, he approached us, president of the society, he approached us about why we weren't joining. We explained this to him. He brought it up with the membership. They rapidly changed the rules and then agreed that if we did, if we took a case, if we had one, a third case, into supervision for a while, they would happily make us members. Donald Spence and I both did that, and George Klein, I believe, did. And I had a third case in process. I met with Peter Richter, I think it was, for about 10 sessions. He approved. He said, this man's doing analysis, me. And I became a member. The last step in this knockdown, drag-out fight was when I decided to join The American. A few years later, when I was publishing more and The American Psychoanalytic became more relevant for me than just a local institute. To join The American, you have to have supervision in the termination phase. So it was steps along the way, but I did not object to any of them. I felt they seemed reasonable to me, and there were things I could do.
But you had an independent base to work from, as you said.
I had an independent base, and yeah, and I had pretty good self-esteem. So.
Obviously. Okay, so as I said, I'd like to get to the substance of your theory more. And let me put it this way. One might say that you have a bi-directional approach. On the one hand, it moves from the clinical to the developmental and from the developmental to the clinical. That is, when you see a clinical phenomenon, you ask yourself, what must this person's development have been like in order for these things to be manifesting themselves? And from the other end, when you investigate a developmental phenomenon, you ask yourself, how might what we're seeing today manifest itself in the adult, either as adaptive or maladaptive behavior, or more often a combination of the two? So I'd like you to comment on that. Tell us about that. But one more thing. Discussion is closely related to the debate between Dan Stern and Andre Green about the relevance of the clinical baby and the developmental baby. So if you like, you might comment on that too.
My first solo book, Developmental Theory and Clinical Process, is divided in exactly the way you say. The first section is called Developmental Problems from a Clinician's Perspective. And the second section is called Clinical Problems from a Developmentalist's Perspective. So my interest was always in what you call the clinical baby rather than the developmental baby. While I did infant observation for a while when I was a consultant to Margaret Mahler, I didn't do very much of it. I'm familiar with that literature. But mostly, my writings on development were essays based on my thinking about development from a clinician's point of view. What might be happening earlier in order to produce the phenomena that we were seeing today? And I like to say, when I'm asked about the source of my developmental ideas, I say, I make them up. And there is truth to that. It's essentially inferential. It's imagining. And it's generally been fairly well respected because I anchor it in a lot of descriptive stuff. which I can't go into detail about. It was my clinical experience that really opened me up most. And that took me way beyond classical theory and Oedipal centrality. Largely, as people say, and it's really true, when patients force things upon you because you get it all wrong with them. So, and other places, because the data are just so there and you can't help responding to it. So I remember that object relations came into, I didn't know what object relations theory was for a long, long time. It was the interns from your school, from City University, who said, "Oh, you must be an object relations theorist." I said, "What's that?" So I remember once saying to a patient who had a particular drive defense conflict, because I was very good at focusing in on that, and I interpreted it every which way and nothing ever happened, I said, "I think you're holding on to this conflict because it's your form of attachment to your parents," which is essentially an object relations interpretation. I didn't think of it as that. I thought it was pretty brilliant at the time. It did shake the patient loose, and then I let it go.
You invented the wheel on your own.
Yeah, I invented the wheel. That's true. When a patient came in who would have been a good coercion patient, or no, not really a coercion, who was all about self-experience, he shook me out of my my automatic rejection, because I was one of the rejectors of the new ideas, like Cohut's, for example. I never really been very much influenced by Cohut's particular theories, but his emphasis on the subjective state of self has become enormously important to me. It's a whole other basic way of thinking. There's the mechanics of what's going on inside you, drive, defense, superego, ego, but there's also the way in, the feelings we have inside as we walk around life, the glasses, black or red or green or yellow, through which we see the world. And so subjective state has become extremely important to me. And it's easy to look at the infant in terms of the development of things like, among subjective states, wholeness and continuity that Cohut talks about, boundaries that Mahler talks about, true and false self, that is genuineness and falsity, that Winnicott speaks about, or agency, which I include in my thinking about self-states. So I've been very receptive. Just as I was receptive to the classical training, I've been receptive to the new ideas that come along. They've enhanced my work. They enter easily into teaching. You said I invented the wheel. When I was speaking about what I call the four psychologies, which I've moved sort of beyond into an emphasis on the workings of mind, it was in one general psychology of the mind. But when I was speaking in Chicago once about drive psychology, ego, self-psychology, and object relations, and their usefulness in the clinical situation, someone from the audience got up and said, "I've read your stuff. I don't understand why it is that not everyone just simply agrees with you." And I said, "I don't understand either, because these are such basic ideas. They're all over the work. And by the way, today, the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association is filled with all of this stuff. I mean, it's now a very broad journal compared to some of the more narrow ones." I'll pause there, because I know you told me you had another question. So,
well, the other question, I mean, one other thing I was going to ask you about was, since you were involved, do you want to say anything about the Stern-Green debate, or should we move on?
There is a developmental baby. Attachment theory is enormously important, as is, I think, Mahler's work. But my interest has largely been in the developmental baby, meaning what might the baby be like that would produce the phenomena that we see in adult analysis?
By the way, something I came across recently, which hadn't struck me before, you know, Winnicott says the same thing. He says he learned much more from treating his borderline and psychotic patients about early development than he did from all of his experience working with mothers and infants. But that's just an aside.
Well, let me say one other thing.
Yeah.
And that is that there's an important idea of mine, which I learned from clinical work on the one side and from observation of children, of babies and children on the other, or from thinking about babies and children and raising my own children on the other. In my clinical work, the Oedipus complex is simply not central anymore. It's central for some, but it's hardly the shibboleth that defines psychoanalysis, as Freud called it. Instead, I find that whatever issues went wrong early on, whatever they were, that's what becomes central in the analysis. And that could be issues of symbiosis and separation, individuation. It could be issues of attachment, of oral phase, of paranoid schizoid thinking or depressive positions. It could be, whatever it is, that is, that fits with what I understand about development, that it begins very early, stuff can go right or wrong right from the beginning on, and the Oedipus complex is simply one more thing that people go through, and each of the phases, some people go through easily, some poorly, and some of them, people go through many of them poorly. But whatever it is that went poorly is what becomes what the analysis is about. And a broader psychoanalytic conception makes room for all of that.
Fred, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I would love to spend hours and hours discussing this with you, but reality is set in and we're going to have to stop here.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.